This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Propax Gold with NT Factor, a complete vitamin and mineral formula. NT Factor is the only nutritional formula clinically proven to reduce fatigue, whatever the cause, age, illness, or just being run down. NT Factor repairs damaged cells and restores healthy bacteria in your digestive tract. Clinical trials have shown NT Factor reduces fatigue by almost half, and it even reverses some symptoms of aging. I've been taking NT Factor for years. With a 45-day money-back guarantee, you have nothing to lose. To order, call 800-982-9158, 800-982-9158, or go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about a very, very urgent subject. We're going to talk about medicine in general because we're making incredible strides in our progress towards eradicating disease. We're coming up with the better and better techniques and treatments, and yet these treatments are, in some cases, costing an astronomical amount of money. And it's been said that there's a big mismatch between the treatments that are available, and the way that we go about paying for them. In fact, we're headed for a big problem in this country because medical expenditures are eating up more and more of our budget, and Medicare is underfunded, and something's got to give. And today we're going to talk to the author of a very, very comprehensive book that deals with this subject. The book is entitled Overcharged: Why Americans Pay Too Much for Healthcare. And you better believe that this is going to be a big issue going forward in the 2020 elections. So virtually diametrically opposed solutions. Some people are proposing universal healthcare a la Canada or Scandinavia. Other people saying we need to cut loose from government-sponsored healthcare. Our guest is one of the co-authors. He's Dr. David Hyman. Dr. Hyman is an MD. He's also a JD, and he's an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. He's a professor at Georgetown University Law Center, and he teaches has taught on healthcare regulations, civil procedure, insurance, medical malpractice, you name it, everything related to the medical system in this country. He's author of numerous papers. And without further ado, here's Dr. Hyman. So welcome to Intelligent Medicine. It's a pleasure having you aboard.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman, for having me.
It's my pleasure. So you, as a physician, what prompted you to write this book?
Well, I've been thinking and writing about healthcare and health law and health policy for quite a while. And so the book, in some ways, is a culmination of a lot of work that I've done with my co-author, Charlie Silver, writing about many of the problems that we've identified in the healthcare system and trying to knit together our work into something that's more publicly accessible, that will let people see both the parts of the healthcare system that are working well and the large parts of the healthcare system that aren't working well, that are very expensive and aren't providing value for the money that people are spending. And it's a lot of money, right? Overall, the United States spends $3.3 trillion. That's the 2016 figures, which are the latest ones available. And, you know, you look at that number and it's hard to make sense of it. But if I tell you for every person in the United States, we're spending about $10,400 on healthcare when the median household income is, you know, $56,000, you get a sense of how much we're spending and how serious a problem it is, both in the absolute level and the rate of growth.
And yet it's been said we're not getting a bang for our buck. You know, we're spending more per capita for healthcare in this country than any other country in the world. And yet healthcare statistics in the U.S. are, you know, not so high, comparable to the rest of the world.
So on the first part of that, you are right that we are spending, you know, controlling for wealth a lot more than other countries. One of the things you discover is as countries get richer, they spend more on healthcare And they have to spend it on some things, and people value health pretty highly. So it makes sense that, you know, as you move from a subsistence level up the income spectrum, you're going to spend more on health care as a country. But we overperform even in that dimension, right? In terms on the second part of the equation, that is, you know, how do we compare to other countries on health? That's actually a much more complicated subject because healthcare often is not a major contributor to health. There are lots of other things that are much more important. And you also have to control for other differences across countries, right? So there'll be differences in the age of different countries' populations. There'll be differences in, you know, how many guns they have access to and other kinds of
social factors,
other social factors that can influence, you know, the rate at which people die and whether they die young or die old and how much disability they experience along the way. So the population measures of health are actually, you know, troublesome, but I'm not sure I lay many of them at the feet of the healthcare system.
Right. Another way of saying that is that health care, no matter how lavish, doesn't necessarily guarantee health. I mean, it's America is a case in point.
That's true, certainly both at the individual level and also at the population level.
Yeah. So I'm going to read from some of the reviews, some really rave reviews of your book. This one's from John Mackey, who's the former CEO of Whole Foods Market. He says, "Overcharged opened my eyes to how truly dysfunctional America's healthcare system has become. Change will come, but only when consumers control their healthcare dollars and begin exerting massive pressure from below." What did he mean by that? That consumers are at the mercy of forces beyond their control at this point?
Well, I think what Mr. Mackey is doing is summarizing one of the principal arguments of our book, which is that third-party payment, especially open-ended third-party payment, that is by insurers and by the government, have given us a system where healthcare providers respond to those third-party payers. They don't respond to consumers. And, you know, the way we explain that is consider if, you know, we paid for anything else the way we pay for healthcare, where somebody else foots the bill. There's a deductible, which if you have very expensive health care, can add up to real money, but it's still a relatively small share of the total cost. And, you know, when some third party is calling the shots, the people who are delivering the services view them as their customer and they behave accordingly. Whereas if ordinary Americans, you know, are buying health care the same way they buy cars and houses and other major consumer purchases, they get what they want. They don't pay more for it than they're willing to pay. And the value proposition looks completely different.
So what are some examples of where the marketplace has been successful in driving down health care costs? I think you cite some instances in the book.
So there are a bunch of instances in the book. I think our, you know, one way to see this is if you go into a drugstore, everything in the store is affordable except the prescription drugs that are behind the counter.
Right. That's true.
Which are paid for by third-party payment.
And you don't see that when you, you know, when you go to the pick up your prescription.
Right. You focus on your copayment,
exactly,
which, you know, could be quite small. But the, you know, the aggregate cost of the drugs can be huge. There are other examples where, you know, consumers buy for things in the healthcare system. So, cosmetic surgery and, laser keratotomy where they do laser vision correction. These are both areas where consumers pay out of pocket. And the book, also gives the example of a particular, hospital, the Surgery Center of Oklahoma, which doesn't deal with insurance. People pay out of pocket and their prices are transparent and affordable. I guess the last example I would give are retail clinics, right? Where you go to your local, you know, Walmart or CVS, and there's a location within there where there's a nurse practitioner who will see you for things like school physicals and strep tests and, you know, a variety of other reasonably significant healthcare conditions where prices are transparent and they're low and the waiting times are low, parking is free. It's very different than your local big city emergency room.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the big elephant in the room, and it looms over the 2020 presidential election, is universal healthcare, which now, which actually was sort of a kind of a way out proposition, maybe a decade or so ago. But it's now become part of central to the platform of some of the aspiring presidential candidates. They point to other countries and say, America is the only country in the world that doesn't have, quote, universal health care. They do it in Canada. They do it in England. They do it in Scandinavia, much of Western Europe. So what's wrong with that? I mean, maybe we need the government to step in to direct this complex system, bring costs down, and make it equitable. That's really the proposition, I think.
Well, that's the claim. And the, reputable economists who have looked at the proposals and tried to score their costs, have come up with numbers that are shockingly large. The difficulty is we have a very expensive healthcare system, and our insurance pays for that expensive healthcare. If you want to lower the cost of health insurance, the best way to do that is to lower the cost of health care. But our government hasn't proven itself to be particularly good at doing that. In fact, the book is full of examples where the government is either captured by the providers, where that is, they make campaign contributions and lobby mm-hmm. heavily yep. for, Medicare to keep paying for unnecessary treatments, for treatments that are more expensive than alternatives. If people were spending their own money, the market takes care of that by itself, right? If you tell me you can go to this emergency room, which is $1,000, or this urgent care center, which is $200, people who are spending their own money flock to the lower price provider. But the government says, we don't care where you go, and we'll pay $1,000 if you happen to go to the more expensive one. That's, a recipe for high costs mm-hmm. and uncontrolled spending.
Well, what about some of these other systems? Are they coming apart at the seams? Is there evidence that that kind of healthcare, government-sponsored healthcare, universal healthcare, call it what you will, socialized medicine, single payer, is that not a workable proposition according to what's happening across the world?
There's a lot of variation across countries in terms of what their system look like, right? So, for example, the National Health Service provides health care through government employees as well as funds it, whereas the Canadian system, the government handles on a provincial level the insurance part of the equation, but the services are provided by private individuals. If you look across countries, you see big differences in the share of their GDP that they're spending, as well as the share of costs that patients are bearing at the point of service. Some of these countries, the population seems happy with their services. Others, there's lots of unrest and unhappiness. When you put these costs on budget, there's always a fight about should we spend money on healthcare or should we spend money on something else. If you think our government is dysfunctional now, wait till it has to make those kinds of decisions mm-hmm. about the allocation of money to healthcare.
Will it lead inevitably to rationing? Will it lead to long wait lists for procedures that Americans can generally get pretty expeditiously these days?
It has in some countries. In other countries, they come up with a variety of strategies to address that. The difficulty is, our government, I think more so than other governments, creates lots of opportunities for people to lobby and influence the way that government behaves. The description we have in the book is that medicine is corrupted by government and government is corrupted by medicine. And we have plenty of examples of that, right? There's this wonderful example where there's an eye doctor in Florida who's doing...
Dr. Solomon Melgen, I think.
Yes, yeah. Dr. Melgen.
I read your book, but also I keep up with the news, and that has something to do with a certain congressman who's not too far distant from our state of New York and New Jersey. Congressman Menendez. Senator Menendez. Yes. Yeah.
Senator Menendez. Yeah. So, you know, this is a wonderful example of somebody who's busily providing unnecessary treatment to hundreds of senior citizens to the tune of millions and millions of dollars a year. And the government seems pretty incapable of stopping him until he's treated all sorts of people. And then when they try to stop him, Dr. Melgen makes a lot of campaign contributions.
I think he built something like in up to $20 million in Medicare billing. He was like the leading biller to the Medicare system when the statistics came out. So it was something astronomical that somehow he managed to code properly, selectively doing certain procedures that were high-ticket procedures, gamed the system, and made a fortune.
So I certainly agree with the made a fortune part. And, you know, he was the number one biller for a series of years. Nobody was sort of watching the money go out the door. I'm happy to explain to your audience how exactly he did it if there's interest. He ends up ultimately being prosecuted, as does Senator Menendez, because Dr. Melgen, you know, did various favors and made huge campaign contributions to try and get Senator Menendez and other influential politicians to get the government to pay the money he had billed and to get them to back off. And there's a truly shocking episode in the book where one staffer in the senator's office calls somebody over at the Medicare program and says, essentially, there's nothing illegal about bad medicine. The government should pay these bills. So think about that. You have a government employee telling another government employee, I understand that this is bad medicine, but the Medicare program exists to shovel money out the door, and that's what it should do. So that's the problem, right? That's the difference in lots of ways, I think, between the American government and other governments who seem able to control the money train much better than we do.
What about the role of specialty medicine societies? You know, they all have their favorite procedures, whether it's the orthopedist with their knee surgeries or the cardiologists with their stents and bypasses. Do they defend their turf when sometimes certain procedures are questioned, you know, in the light of evidence-based medicine, they don't turn out to work so well?
Of course they do. You know, everybody thinks their specialty is special, and that their judgment as to what should be done shouldn't be questioned. But, you know, these are large amounts of money per unit of service. The typical way that the government tries to control this is it aggressively goes after the payment per unit of service, but it doesn't pay any attention at all to the volume. And so you end up seeing, you know, a perpetual game of whack-a-mole, where the government tries to clamp down and then providers find a different way of, you know, keeping whatever they view as their target income. You see this over and over again. The book gives lots of examples. Now, there is another issue where the setting of payment levels for physicians is heavily influenced by a committee which is disproportionately controlled by specialists. And, you know, the nature of healthcare is we pay quite a lot for procedures being done and much less for people thinking, cognitive,
right,
diagnostic.
And much less for primary care if the doctors are actually in the trenches dealing with, you know, in many cases, seniors, disadvantaged populations. Those folks make a lot of less money than, you know, your Park Avenue eye doctor or cardiologist.
There's a reason why Dr. Melgen was number one, and it's hard to find a geriatrician.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, that creates an incentive in medical school for these kids who have enormous debts to pursue a specialty that's lucrative to basically pay down their debts and, you know, amortize the investment in a medical education, which is years and years of deferred gratification.
Yeah, that in lots of ways is another theme of the book, that we get what we choose to pay for, and how we choose to pay for it influences what we get. So if we're unhappy with the way the system looks currently, we shouldn't moralize or complain. We should just change the incentives. And the reason why we think we ought to put consumers in charge of the spending is because that's the way to get the system to serve their interests.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you say, and these economists have come up with these estimates of, you know, multiple trillions of dollars. And I think one estimate was like $32 trillion over 10 years to implement the plans that some of the presidential candidates are advocating for our healthcare system. But in the book, you actually do a little bit of a thought experiment. You say, look, forget the economic implications, the trillions of dollars that we don't have that we would go into hock to spend. What about the moral imperative? Isn't access to healthcare, and this is a phrase that keeps coming up, a basic human right? And isn't America ready to incorporate that in our pact with our citizens?
So, you know, the difficulty with calling things human rights is somebody else needs to ensure that that's actually provided. And the argument in the book is that there's a strong moral argument for allowing people to spend money, and if they don't have it, to give them money to allow them to get access to what they value, right? The current system is set up to give you what the designers of Medicare or mm-hmm. the designers mm-hmm. of your health insurance think you ought to get. Mm-hmm. And we have another thought experiment that says, you know, that one way to understand what Medicare actually values and prioritizes is to look what it doesn't pay for, right? So mm-hmm. if you want to have your hips replaced and your knees replaced and to go to the doctor three times a week from now until the cows come home, the Medicare program will happily pay for all mm-hmm. of those things. Yep. But if you want to, you know, pay for a home health aide to keep you in your house at a cost that's much lower than doing all that fancy surgery, the Medicare program says, no, we're not going to cover that. You're on your own. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is not an argument for why the Medicare program should pay for those things in addition to all the other things it pays for. It's an argument that we should give people money and let them spend it as they see fit, mm-hmm. and they'll be happier, and the healthcare system will perform better, too.
I guess an analogy would be, you know, if there was such a thing as a government car, and every U.S. citizen was to be issued a government car, as part of a human right. You know, everybody has a right to transportation, to mobility, and they get a government car. But then some people wouldn't be happy with that government car, and they'd say, you know, I'd like a bit. Well, no, I'm sorry, that's the car you're getting. Well, that car is not good enough, or that car is, not the way I want it to be. Is that an analogy that's appropriate to this? You're saying, actually, you're not saying that people who are poor, impoverished, should be denied the basic income that enables them to afford healthcare. You're just saying the way it's set up, they get a form of healthcare that's like a government car.
Yeah, except it's worse than that along two dimensions, right? So what's worse with the government car dynamic is that the people who are manufacturing cars will lobby heavily for it to have all the bells and whistles. Yep. That they would like included. And, you know, well-educated upper-middle-class people will lobby for cars that match their preferences. But one of the things you learn by looking at the car market or the transportation market more broadly is that they're widely divergent tastes and widely divergent budgets. And trying to come up with, you know, you can have whatever car you want as long as it's the one I happen to be selling is not a good way of giving people what they want. Right. Indeed. Some people want to drive a Lexus, and other people would prefer to drive, you know, a Yugo and pocket the difference mm-hmm. and spend it on, you know, sending their kids to college or living in a nicer place or having a shorter commute. Right. Preferences vary. Mm-hmm. And this is not about denying the poor anything. In fact, we actually argue that our system is much more protective of the interests of the poor because high prices for health care hurt them the worst, much more than they hurt upper middle class people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, this is a good point at which to pause because we've got lots more to discuss. The book is Overcharged, Why Americans Pay Too Much for Healthcare. We're talking to one of the co-authors, Dr. David Hyman, who along with Charles Silver wrote this comprehensive book with a critique of the American medical system, but also with proposed solutions. We'll delve into those in just a few moments. Stay with us for part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.